Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in San Francisco, California today. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in Niles, Ohio.
And today is the 75th anniversary of the beginning of the Korean War. And so we're going to be talking about the Korea and the history and the politics for the last 125, 150 years, maybe longer. But we'll just be doing a little bit of a deep dive into this sort of important piece of history. And joining us to do that today is Tim Sharrock, who is an American writer and commentator on U.S. foreign policy, national security and intelligence, and East Asian politics, particularly around the Korean Peninsula. He's the author of The Political Economy of the Pacific Rim and Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Many articles in places like The Nation and other outlets like that. Also, I think recently dropped Site News. And so, Tim, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks. I really appreciate it. We'll start with some background, and we can take this wherever you feel it's important. I know this is my field of studies, U.S. foreign relations, so I was forced to read a lot. Not forced, I wanted to, but I read a lot about this. But it's really critical because this is a period when the United States is becoming a global power in the late 19th century. It sends warships to Japan in, 1853, 1854 with Commodore Perry. And then by the 1890s, the U.S. has this vision of a much broader commercial empire. And Asia is really critical to that based on this doctrine of what they call the open door, free trade, busting open these markets elsewhere because of America's economic strength. And that's right. How, in this larger context of Asia, how Korea becomes important. And I know a lot of times, like in the books I read, it would often start in 1905, where the story would begin. And you can either do that or give the a little background or to that even. So how does the United States finally get an interest, get involved in Korean relations as well as the larger East Asian Pacific theater?
It began in the late 1800s. And of course, that time, Korea was under the Joseon monarchy. Joseon became the name for Korea later. And it was a long time tributary of China. And then other countries, the imperialist power started coming in the region and breaking it up into zones of influence and taking over parts of Asia for themselves. And Russia, France, etc., were all over the Pacific Rim. But of course, Japan, when the U.S. opened Japan forcibly in 1854, Admiral Perry sailed his famous black ships into Japan and forcibly opened up the country. He came back, he showed them his guns, made some demands that they should open up to trade. And they had been closed at that time. It was under this feudal regime. It had been closed for 200 years to any foreigners. And they opened it up. And then about a dozen years later, the royal family overthrew this feudal regime and started to modernize and built up Japan as a military power. They brought in Germans to help rebuild the military and so on. And the U.S. tried to open Korea twice in the 1860s. And both times they sent a ship in to northern Korea to replicate what Perry had done, but it was attacked and completely destroyed by fire rafts by the order of the king. And then a few years later, they tried to occupy an island near Seoul, present-day Seoul, but it too was attacked, and there was a very bloody fight. And the ships withdrew, and the U.S. finally withdrew. And then after that, the Koreans, the monarchy, tried to exclude everybody, all foreigners, but the onslaught just kept coming. And in the 1870s, Japan had been modernized, and its military become a military power, and they opened it by force in the late 1800s. And then they signed a treaty, and then everyone else started signing treaties with Korea. And one of them, of course, was the U.S. And in 1899, as we know, there was a Spanish-American War, and McKinley, defeated the Spanish, and then they sailed into Manila Harbor, and they made the, took over the Philippines and made the Philippines really the U.S. first colony. And so they, and then it was strangely enough, the U.S. at the time saw Japan as this modernizing force in Asia, didn't really see them as a problem as far as the other, like the other imperialist powers. And they, of course, the U.S. at the same time seized Hawaii. And so they were really becoming a force in the Asia Pacific area, or at least trying to. And in the late 1890s, mid-1890s, there was this big rebellion, a peasant rebellion against foreigners in Korea. And all these military powers, the imperialist powers, all sent troops into Korea to try to, under the guise of protecting their citizens. But it was this clashes between all these imperialist powers. Russia moved in big time. And then Japan and Russia got into a war, and Japan basically crushed the Russians. And this is what happened in 1905. And this is taught to many Korean school children in school. In the aftermath of Japan's victory, President Theodore Roosevelt mediated this peace agreement between Japan and Russia. And Japan had already forced the Korean monarchy to sign documents that allowed Japan to manage its economy and run its political affairs. And Theodore Roosevelt thought this was just great. He just thought this would be good because it would keep Japan away from, it would keep Korea out of the clutches of Russia, which is something, of course, the Koreans began to hear a lot about. And he cut this deal with Japan that was negotiated by William Howard Taft, who was at that time Secretary of Defense and later the Secretary of War and later became president. And it gave Japan the right to take whatever actions it wanted for the, quote, guidance, control, and protection of Korea, which basically made it a colony. And then 5 years later, Japan formally annexed Korea and made it a colony. But as the U.S., Japan agreed to recognize Philippines as the U.S. colony. So that set the stage for what came later. And Japan said, fine, you take the Philippines. And the U.S. said, fine, you take Korea. And so then the Japanese began to, over the next 40 years, deepen their control and integrated Korea into their, once they took, they invaded Manchuria and China, they took over basically a huge chunk of Northeast Asia and China. And Korea was completely integrated with that. In fact, the Japanese developed the Korean industrial economy just as part of the Japanese empire, built huge petrochemical plants and all kinds of industries there that were all part of the Japanese military industrial complex. But there was a lot of resistance in Korea. And because the Japanese were so vicious in putting down any kind of resistance, just murdering, slaughtering people and putting thousands and thousands in jail and prisons, there was significant Korean opposition to this. But they had to leave the country. And a lot of them went to fight in Manchuria. A lot of them went to fight in China, different parts of China. And most of those people who left were leftists or became communists. And they eventually joined up with the Soviet Red Army and also the Chinese Revolutionary Forces that were the Communist Party of China that was trying to overthrow Chiang Kai-shek and also fight the Japanese. So this, and then to win the loyalty of Koreans, Japan began to integrate Korean soldiers into its military and police forces. And Korea was really bifurcated into people that were basically siding with the colonial forces and collaborating with Japan, and then the resistance that was mostly communist and leftist and was against Japanese control and any kind of imperial control over Korea. And what happened when Korea was divided by the United States in 1945. That was a unilateral decision by the Truman administration that Stalin agreed with later. they said, divide the peninsula. And basically the idea was take as much of Korea as the U.S. could to keep these leftists from taking over Korea, who had been fighting the Japanese, who you one would think would have been our allies, but no. And then these, so the leftist military forces and resistance forces eventually became the heart and soul of the North Korean military and government that was established by the Soviets in their occupation of the North. And these collaborators, pro-Japanese collaborators, basically fascists, became the heart and soul of the army that the U.S. created in between 1945 and 1950. And so the schisms within Korea really date back to 1905 and the colonization of Korea by Japan. So that leaves us at 1945.
Within the context of building up to that, the Japanese occupation, as you pointed out, was very vicious. Didn't they also take Korean men and women back to Japan to like essentially do labor in factories, and the women march with the army, the comfort women and so forth?
Yes, there was basically mass kidnappings and slave labor. That was mostly during World War II, after Japan attacked the U.S. in Pearl Harbor and invaded Southeast Asia and also the Philippines, and all the Pacific Islands. And so they would forcibly kidnap Korean girls and women from some other countries. And they had built what they called comfort stations for Japanese soldiers. And so it was like this forced military form of prostitution. It wasn't prostitution, it was slavery, sex slaves. And they had these all over the place on these comfort stations. And of course, because so many Japanese men were fighting in the war, they forcibly brought many Korean laborers to work in Japanese factories and coal mines during the war. And all that is still a really big issue. But the Japanese were just incredibly cruel, such that the resistance was just, they tried to wipe it out. And they did a pretty good job, actually, of wiping it out. But like I said, the resistance was very strong outside of Korea.
And with the Chinese, the Chinese were much, I know that Mao's revolutionary forces much more aligned with the Korean left. But did we also see the non-communist forces like Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Kai-shek's forces basically also tried to manipulate and work their way into Korea? Or is it mostly dominated by the Japanese?
It was mostly dominated by the Japanese during World War II. Of course, there was no Chinese influence. But afterwards, once Chiang Kai-shek fled to Taiwan, and then one of the first things Truman did during the Korean War, when he decided to intervene and bring in hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers. They also sent the 7th Fleet into the Taiwan Straits to block any chance of China taking Taiwan, which of course they wanted to do with Chiang Kai-shek there. During the early parts of the U.S. occupation of Korea and into the 50s, Syngman Rhee, who was the right-wing dictator that the U.S. basically appointed to rule the country under U.S. control. And they were a close ally of Chiang Kai-shek. And they tried, that's where like the origins of the real Asian far right during the Cold War are. Rhee and Chiang Kai-shek and a bunch of other foreign dictators.
No, Dinh Diem in Vietnam.
Yeah, and Dinh Diem, all these people. And in fact, Syngman Rhee offered to send Korean troops to Vietnam long before Park Chung-hee did later during the Cold War. When the Vietnam War really became a major war. But that was the origins of that kind of linkage. Basically, it was run South Korea, the U.S., when the U.S. occupied South Korea, all of Korea was in a kind of revolutionary fervor. Finally, it had been liberated. And the people overwhelmingly wanted to get rid of all the Japanese and the remnants of Japanese colonialism. And it was a largely, especially in the South, it was largely a peasant society. And there was a huge demand and need for land reform, redistribution of land. Same was true in North Korea. the North Korean government, the communist government that the Soviet Union helped set up, they didn't just appoint people, but it was certain leaders and factions of the North Korean, of the Korean resistance came together. Like Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, well known as the founder of North Korea, had fought for years and years in Manchuria with mostly Soviet forces. And of course, the propaganda now is that he was just Stalin's man, but that wasn't entirely true. He was an actual fighter against the Japanese. Yeah. And there was other factions too. There was a Yunnan faction that had fought with the Chinese revolutionaries and had been based in Yunnan, where Mao Zedong was, and then Chou Enlai through the war. And there was a third faction of leftists in North Korea that was more, it was actually led by a very famous Christian leader in the North that were just independence leaders. And some of the independence leaders did help form the Republic of Korea in the South, but because of the Cold War, the U.S. General John Hodge, who ran the U.S. military government, he looked at anybody who had any kind of thinking about independence or demonstrated against the U.S. military occupation. They're communists dictated by Stalin and just had to be stomped out. So they created this government of landlords, Korean collaborators, rich people who had collaborated with the Japanese. And they built an army out of these Koreans who had served the Japanese, and not only in World War II, but they helped lead soldiers fighting the Korean resistance within North Korea and Manchuria. And these are the soldiers that Park Chung-hee, right, became dictator for 18 years in a military coup. He was trained by the Japanese, and he brought in all these generals who had been also trained by the Japanese, including in military-led industrialization in Manchuria and Northern Korea. And that's what the Korean economic model of the post-war, World War years was founded on, basically. The government-led, military-led, economic, manufacturing, industrial.
This is really similar to Vietnam, of course. Talk a little bit more about the resistance for a minute, because one of the ideas you'll hear in Vietnam and Korea all over, actually, is that kind of outside forces were responsible for these changes, the Soviet Union in particular. And as you pointed out, I think it's important, like that this resistance is indigenous, right? It's unique, led by Kim Il-sung. It has legitimacy and it's fighting against the Japanese. And it's not, because in the U.S., you would hear this about Vietnam as well, that it was like either imposed upon them by the Soviet or the Chinese communists. When the reality is, I'm assuming in Korea, right? It's an indigenous resistance that immediately emerges against Japan. Yeah.
Like I said, when Truman and his advisors made the decision to divide, and of course, this division, the line was drawn very hastily, right? They exploded, they bombed Nagasaki with the second, with this plutonium weapon, the second use of atomic weapons on people, on civilians. And then within 24 hours, Japan had folded. And so the U.S. had to instruct the Japanese forces how to accept the U.S., where to accept the U.S. surrender terms, right? And of course, there was a huge Japanese force in Korea. Truman and his advisors, who included Abel Harriman, who at that time was the U.S. ambassador to Moscow. The Harriman is a big railroad magnate family, right? And Harriman's father had deep interests, and he tried to buy called the Southern Manchuria Railroad, and they had all kinds of interest in building railroad. And anyway, Harriman urged Truman to send in, to occupy South Korea with U.S. military forces and send them as far north as possible. And as Bruce Cummings found in the research he originally did in the 70s, they weren't scared of Stalin taking over Korea. They were scared of all these Korean communists and leftists that had fought the Japanese. And in fact, that's who they tried to, that's why they drew the line so hastily, because the Soviets entered the war like 4 or 5 days before Japan surrender, and they just crushed the Japanese armies in Manchuria and went into, crossed into Korea And they even crossed into the southern part of Korea. And so the U.S. was looking at that and they're like freaking out, but like putting the Russians had all, like I said before, had interests in Korea for, you know, hundreds of years. And it's, they have a small border with Korea as well. And so they're right there. The U.S. had never had any interest, strategic interest in Korea whatsoever. And like Bruce Cummings has written, like the U.S. occupation was really sending in troops. It was really the first act of containment, because that was what they were trying to do, is to contain not Soviet forces, but Korean indigenous communist forces from taking the whole peninsula. And if the U.S. hadn't done that, for sure, or if they hadn't delayed, that they hadn't dropped a bomb and had been fighting in Japan, the Soviets and their allies would have taken all of Korea easily. The people wanted revolution. They wanted an end to the colonial situation. And so in those post-war years, like in North Korea, Northern Korea, were fairly peaceful in terms of land reform and the revolution that took place, because people, by and large, supported it. They wanted the reforms and they wanted the changes, right? In South Korea, a lot of people wanted the same changes, but when they saw what the U.S. had installed as a government and what the U.S. military was doing and putting down any kind of resistance, not only armed, any kind of resistance, they rebelled. And by 1946, there was like almost like a full-fledged guerrilla war taking place in South Korea. There was a great American reporter named Mark Gay, who was a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And he wrote a book, mostly he had been in Japan during the occupation. He went over to Korea in 1946. Like his first day there, he gets in the Jeep with some American soldiers and there he sees smoke over somewhere. And they're talking about getting the gooks. We're fighting the gooks up there. But they were fighting as early as 1946. And one of the I've done a lot of research in the National Archives on the Korean War, as I have a lot of Korean scholars. And I found this one amazing series of military reports from that period from like the south central part of Korea, where there was like, it was just like full, like Mark Gann reported, it was like full scale rebellion, like 1,000 farmers gather in a, take over a police station and kill 3 of the police and demand land reform, and the U.S. sends troops to put it down and restore the police at that station, just day after day after day of this kind of incident. And then there was, this is all the Korean, we talked about June 25th, that's the day the North Korean forces crossed into South, and that's officially the start of the Korean War, but the Korean War really began much earlier than that in the South, with this counterinsurgency that the U.S. organized. And here they had all these Korean generals trained by the Japanese, anti-communists to the core. And they had the same thing with the Korean police force. And when the island of Jeju, they had the largest island in Korea, just south of the mainland. And it was a province to itself. And under U.S. pressure, Syngman reorganized this election, whether Korea should be divided or not, or declare itself a separate republic. And there was a rebellion in Jeju. Jeju was the only province to vote to be part of a unified Korea. They did not want Korea to be divided. A lot of the other Koreans didn't either. But that was the only province to vote like that. And there was an uprising began that also was against abuses by the Korean, the U.S., Japanese-trained Korean forces the U.S. installed there as police. And this grew into a provincial-wide rebellion that was put down with great brutality by the U.S. military government and its Korean collaborators. They killed about a third of the island, over 30,000 people were killed very brutally, scorched earth campaign. They just slaughtered men, women, children, old, young, whatever. They just slaughtered them. And a lot of the people that were sent to Jeju to fight the left were North Koreans, people who had left North Korea. They were like this fascist army of North Koreans who hated communism in North Korea because their land was confiscated. They hated communism for that reason. So there was Jeju, which Koreans knew about it at the time, but then the history was covered up. And then some of the Korean military, there was this rebellion, it's called the Yosu Rebellion, where Korean soldiers that were being sent to Jeju to fight this counterinsurgency war refused to go. And they were kind of led by this kind of leftist faction. Somehow it got as part of the military nationalist leftist faction. And so there was that rebellion was also put down by the U.S. and its South Korean collaborators in 1948-49. And from 46 to basically the start of when North Korea invaded was civil war inside South Korea. And all this history is completely hidden from the American people, still hidden from the Americans.
Yeah, that was my question just in everything about the military or like intelligence agencies, but like how can a similar period, but then in the similar period in Europe, we saw like American labor basically working with the CIA to help make sure that leftists didn't get elected to office in Italy or France. The American media is very complicit. Korea is known as the forgotten war. How much of this was the American public aware of, or was the media so complicit in this that it was until North Korea crossed the 30th parallel, they were unaware of what was happening?
There was no reporting. There was just people like Mark Kane. If you were lucky enough to read the Chicago Sun-Times, lucky enough to read some of the leftist publications like The Nation or The Guardian covering this, Americans completely blind. And of course, the American press was totally infatuated with the occupation of Japan. And of course, we had fought Japan in World War II, so that's what Americans were most interested in. Of course, they didn't know about the leftist opposition, the leftist Japanese opposition to the U.S. either, which there was a lot of, until the conservatives in Japan basically crushed with the help of the U.S. But it was just, there was nothing known. And so then when North Korea attacked, they had to make up all this. It was just like this fiction war. Now we're fighting against Stalin is trying to take over all of Asia, and this is the first step, and blah, 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 blah. It scared the hell out of the Americans. But no one even knew where it was. Most Americans could not find it on a map. The only Americans that knew about Korea were missionaries who had lived there. And to be fair, the American missionaries, which were very predominant, especially in Northern Korea. Northern Korea, during the 30s and 40s, was known as the Jerusalem of Asia because North Korea was the center of Christianity in Korea. And the missionaries, the message of Christianity was strong in Korea because for people under colonialism, just like it was, you know, to American black slaves in America, the liberation promised by Christianity was fundamental to people that revolted against slavery. And the same in Korea, is that message of human liberation was really echoed in Korea. And the missionaries, at least some of them, when Korea was under severe repression after like the rebellion of 1919, this famous rebellion in Korea against Japan, the missionaries sent all kinds of reports, photographs of violence inflicted on Koreans. And so that was a small group that understood what was happening. But of course, they were also anti-communist to the core. And my parents were missionaries growing up in Japan. And when I was growing up in Japan and South Korea, they were mostly relief workers. But they were full of this anti-communist fervor as well. They changed. And my dad became a prominent critic of the Vietnam War, led a march of Americans against the war in 1968. My first public demonstration. So they changed, but they learned from their experience. But it was a real time of tumult. And in the days before North Korea's invasion, it's really hard to call it an invasion, I think. It's a country that was just divided by unilateral U.S. It had never, it had always been a united country, 5,000 years of history. So it's, I just can't, saying it's an invasion of your own country, that's sort of sad. That stretches credibility, I think. But they moved the year 1949 to 1950. A lot of the revolution in China was 1949, October 1st. And in the months after, a lot of Koreans had been fighting in China to help the revolution. And in the year after, these were like really trained fighters, right? And so a lot of them returned to Korea in the last year, 49 to 50. And meanwhile, there was all these, right before the North Koreans crossed the line, there had been an election in South Korea where Syngman Rhee lost control of the National Assembly. And a lot of leftists were actually elected in this climate of severe anti-communism. They were elected, and there were a lot of people who wanted unification were also elected. And so Rhee was really in trouble. And meanwhile, there had been tens of thousands of North Korean Christians had left and poured into South Korea. And these were, a lot of them didn't leave until the Korean War, but before, the many came down, and pastors would come down with their entire congregations. And so there was this real fundamentalist anti-communist Christian population in South Korea that, of course, the U.S. saw as they were going to save them, communists. And in the last months before the war began, there were lots of talks and negotiation between South Koreans who wanted to have unification, but were far from communists. A lot of them were right-wingers who just wanted a unified Korea. And they met with, across the border, and met with the leaders at the time of North Korea. And they tried to strike a deal, but by the time June 25th came along, Syngman Rhee, with the help of the U.S., had completely wiped out any kind of armed rebellion in the South. According to this well-known U.S. diplomat who was in Seoul in the 40s, over 100,000 people in South Korea were executed for being alleged communists before the war began. 100,000? That's a lot. And in 1949, as I'm writing in my book, based on interviews I've done with South Korean historians, that was the bloodiest year of the repression. When you read about it, it's just horrendous. It was like the Spain under Franco during the Spanish Civil War. Just brutal torture, repression, and thousands of civilians rounded up and executed. And then when the North Korean army came down, of course, and almost kicked the U.S. out. And then the U.S., MacArthur, led this invasion at Incheon. And I think if the U.S. had stopped at the border, that would have been one thing. Maybe they would have gotten credit for saving South Korea. But Truman and his people were determined to roll, what they called rollback, right? So a lot of people don't know this either. In October 1950, the U.S. and its UN army, right, British, Turks, et cetera, multi-American, South Korean, of course, invaded North Korea. They took Pyongyang. They occupied the country and wanted to have this unified Korea. And, of course, MacArthur was saying, oh, the boys are going to be all about Christmas. Americans are following this. And it was not popular in America. You have another war in Asia soon after World War II. And MacArthur was just a complete fool. He just thought North Korean army was just a bunch of peasants and some of this Chinese army that couldn't do anything. And of course, he was dead wrong. And the Chinese did not want the U.S. colony on the border on the Yalu River. So of course,
when I piece this, I show a map which has arrows up and down. It's really quite striking. I've never seen a military campaign that rapidly, which makes that many changes. But to go back, you mentioned America's strategic interest. And in early 1950, Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, was asked the question about America's interest in Asia, and he excluded Korea. He didn't mention Korea in it. I believe this is in January, February. Yet in June, the United States goes to the UN and declares war. It's an American war. What changes in that 4 or 5 months from Acheson saying, oh, Korea is not important to us, to this is the place where we're going to fight the first hot war of the post-war era? Is it, I know, like part of the lore is NSC 68 is plays into this, all kinds of other stuff. But what do you, what accounts do you think for that shift from America?
Actually, that Acheson speech, that's become one of the great myths of the Korean War. This is why North Korea invaded, as he said.
Oh, no, I don't think that at all.
I know that, but I'm saying this. It's just like about a month ago, that's what I read in the New York Times by his White House correspondent, basically the same thing, right? When he was saying why Trump's policies were bad and not supporting allies. That's what Acheson did. Actually, at the time, the idea was, okay, Japan is, obviously they occupied Japan because Japan attacked the United States. So that was one thing. But other countries that they would try to maintain as anti-communist bastions, they wanted those governments to fight the war for them. They thought we would be, it was kind of like nation building in Iraq or something. Okay, we're going to basically represent American interests and you carry out these liberal policies with your people and respect human rights and so on. And, but of course, be anti-communist and we'll support you. The U.S. had, in both the U.S. and Soviet Union, had withdrawn their occupation forces by 1949. But the U.S. kept 500 military advisors in South Korea to train this enormous army that they had built during that time. And 500 advisors is that's not a small number. That means they're just basically running the whole Korean army, Korean military. And actually, even the CIA put out an interesting little booklet a couple of years ago that was, they released a lot of new classified information about the Korean War and Truman's decisions at that time. And one of the things they said in this report was that whatever Acheson said, Truman, behind the scenes, in speeches to his National Security Council and other kinds of briefings in Congress, whatever, Truman made it very clear that if North Korea tried to intervene in South Korea, that the U.S. would intervene militarily. And there's lots of documents. The CIA laid out those documents. And even if it was said privately or to the CIA or whatever, you got to remember that during this time, the Korean War, I forget which of the English spies was in Washington, who was the liaison to U.S. intelligence during the Korean War. Was it Guy Burgess? Anyway.
Burgess or Philby?
Philby. No, Philby was in somewhere else. I think it was Guy.
Yeah, I think it was Burgess. Yeah.
And basically, he said all the intelligence, U.S. intelligence to Moscow, and of course it got to North Korea.
Right.
So Kim Il-sung would have been, and the other leaders in North Korea probably would have been briefed by the Soviets in North Korea. Well, the intelligence state picked up that Truman will do this. Basically, Kim Il-sung made a huge gamble. Like he looked at China. In the end, the U.S. Chiang Kai-shek regime, you know, was just so riddled with corruption. No popular support. It collapsed. And the U.S. could have tried to save it, but they just said that we can't save it. Carcass. There's nothing worth saving here, and they didn't intervene. And of course, that led to old purges of the State Department. Who lost China? This whole
thing. Doesn't the China lobby become the Korea lobby? Like fairly abruptly.
They did. More. So they're a powerful force in Washington at the time. But the thing is, during that time, the U.S. made it very clear that they would act. And I think then once NSC 68 came into play and we'll fight communism anywhere, any place, et cetera, that became the Truman doctrine.
Right.
So they, and it also became like this, it was just like prestige. Oh, we can't lose this U.S. colony, basically, and show how weak we are. We have to save it by any means. It didn't have anything to do with Korea. That was the thing. Really, it could have been anywhere. Like he just had done the same thing in Greece when he'd intervened there too,
right,
to prevent communists from taking over. that the Greek government or crush a communist revolt against the government. You know, Kim Il-sung made a gamble. He thought because the U.S. didn't intervene in China, they wouldn't intervene in Korea. It was too small potatoes. I think that was his assumption. And also, the other guy who was kind of his co-leader in North Korea at the time was he had been the communist leader in the South. And he had basically, part of their plan was the South Korean people will rise up once the North Koreans invade. And he also turned out to be wrong. Although there was a lot of resistance by communist guerrilla forces in South Korea who joined the North Korean army or fought battles against the U.S. and the U.N. army in South Korea. There was guerrilla warfare went on in this mountains of South and Central Korea for years during the Korean War and afterwards too. So there was resistance, but there wasn't a mass flooding of people to join the North Korean army. And they're as brutal as any army. Of course, they didn't have any air power. You know, listening to Trump the other day talking about we have complete domination around the skies. I've heard that, but that's what the U.S. said in the early days of Korea. And but you read the history of the war, what's his name? The guy who led the bombing of Japan. What was the general? Ran with Wallace.
LeMay.
Curtis LeMay. He said, we bombed Korea, both North and South. We even bombed Incheon. We didn't mean to, but we did it anyway. So I had like a few days when the North Koreans came in, there was like tremendous. They took Seoul really quickly. And then when the U.S. MacArthur sent its forces into Incheon, battle for Seoul was cost thousands of lives. The U.S. just destroyed the city in order to save it, like later in Vietnam. And it was a massive battle. And finally, the North Koreans withdrew. But that's where I was born right at that time, 1951. And actually, my dad had been to Korea in 1949. And he actually went there working for the World Council of Churches to build housing for all these North Korean Christians who fled there. But my dad was there in 1949, like 6 months before the war started. And in his letters, he was really shocked because he saw these fascist youth gangs modeled on the Hitler youth running through Seoul and beating up leftists and stuff like that. And then Syngman Rhee kept promising to invade, liberate North. And this is really a dicey situation. It's like sitting on a volcano. And was right. He had a friend who was shot by a sniper right after Incheon. And he had a friend that was kidnapped, was captured by the North Koreans, spent 3 years in miserable conditions in North Korean prison camp, pretty much. And then he was in Korea after the war as running this huge private relief organization, worked very closely with the government, bringing in post-war relief. But the situation, he understood the dynamics, but this was all completely hidden from the American people and just completely Truman and his people, they so exaggerated the situation. And then the American reporters that went in didn't understand it either. Of course, they just reported on what Americans going through. And although a lot of times they would, if you read those reports, Margaret Higgins and people like that, it became very famous reporting. They knew that South Korea was a fascist regime, and they were aware of all kinds of atrocities by South Koreans. And so we're just trying to make Korea really tell them, improve them, help them out, et cetera, et cetera.
Make South Korea great again. One question, go back to what you said something earlier, but just also what you just said, is that we see these massacres and these purges that were going on from the right-wing Japanese collaborative government. How much of an impact? I know that in the 1970s and definitely in the 1980s, we have these big pro-democracy social movements in South Korea. How much of those purges and those massacres really impacted that movement developing in a more significant way sooner?
Actually, what stopped it was repression. So in 1960, right, when I was living there as a kid, Syngman Rhee was overthrown, right, in this massive student-led revolution. Mm-hmm. It actually became, that really inspired Tom Hayden, Student for Democratic Society here. Tom Hayden wrote and spoke about this a few times. Like, they were really inspired by these South Korean students overthrowing this fascist regime. But, and then the year after, in 1960 to 1961, people started, like, all these massacres that had taken place in mountain villages and stuff. People began demanding retribution for one thing, but justice for the people that had been slaughtered in these mass executions. And so they would build memorials to them and hold public rallies and to bring this to the public attention. We can't forget these people were slaughtered by our own government, that kind of thing. And 1961, and also during that time, a lot of people in the South were talking about reunifying with North Korea. And when students were trying to meet with students from North Korea, going up to the border, doing, even like in the U.S., Mike Mansfield, who was senator from Montana, you know, he was calling for a neutral, unified Korea. And that idea drew some interest from some Americans, but a lot of Koreans were like, yeah, that's what we want. But then, of course, 1961, this Park Chung-hee was trained by the Japanese, took over in a military coup, and all this stuff was crushed. The movement, any Park Chung-hee regime over time, especially after 1972, became a complete torture state, one of the most vicious police states the world has ever known. And any movement like this, you could not write about, say, the Jeju Rebellion. If anyone wrote about it, brought in and tortured by the Korean CIA, it really was, you could not bring up the past. The only way that changed was having a democratic, well, I don't know if it's fair to call it a revolution, but in terms of what they were dealing with, it was a revolution. There was a Kwangju uprising in 1980 that became the kind of rallying cry all during the 80s. And by 87, they had forced the military to back off and allow re-election. And that's only then did South Korea become a democracy. And only then were scholars and journalists allowed to look into this past. So a lot of the history of this period is all new history. In fact, it's books are coming out just now. Last year, a book came out about the U.S. role in putting down the Jeju Uprising. And it took years of work by people going into the National Archives here in D.C. to find a lot of these documents. In fact, a lot of post-war Japan and post-war Korea's history is in those National Archives. And for that reason, like the Japanese Diet Library, the relative equivalent of the Library of Congress, has at one point sent hundreds of people to copy all these documents that were in U.S. possession from Japan during the occupation. And lots of Koreans have done the same thing. You may remember the story about Nogun Rhee, the massacre of U.S. Army soldiers, Korean civilians under a bridge. There were some people that knew about that. And then someone finally went in the National Archives and dug around and find the stories. And that's how AP wrote a story. I forget what year it was, but they won the Pulitzer for that investigation.
Yeah.
Of course, the U.S. said we had responsibility for and blah, blah, blah. But that history is amazingly in the National Archives. And I've dug up all kinds of stuff like that. And periods like when I was there during the 80s, none of the stuff from the 80s, which is really important, has been declassified yet. I'm constantly finding new documents on the CIA site, which are their, that online library of stuff that's been declassified, which is really quite a resource, actually.
I'm afraid it's going to, I hope it's still there, because I'm afraid they're going to take that down given everything else that's going on.
They probably will, but it's still up.
I've used it a lot.
Yeah,
let me go back a minute, because you've been talking about the hidden history and the myths. Hidden history obviously reminds me of Ivan Stone. But to go back to 1950, because I think this is important as well. No. So by September, the North Korean advances all the way down almost the entire peninsula, right, to Busan. And then you have the counter, right? And you mentioned October, and I think this is part of that mythology as well, because the U.S. does, in October, cross into the north, and then you have American officers, the intelligence officer, who was the guy, the John Bircher, was it Willoughby or something like that? Who's saying, oh, don't worry about China, nothing's going to happen.
They're a bunch of pedants.
Part of the mythology has now become that MacArthur unilaterally went north and Truman, but the reality is, right, Truman was down with that as well. That was, they were on the same page.
Absolutely. He fired him for threatening to drop 20 nuclear bombs on China, widening the war to China. Truman didn't give a shit about Korea. And him and his advisors, Acheson being one of them, did this. And the interesting thing about it is that, like, when the Korean War began, when the North Koreans crossed the 38th parallel, the Pentagon itself, the U.S. military, was against intervention. They just thought, we don't have any strategic reason to be there. And they said, they thought the same thing in 1945, most of the military.
And I know somebody who wrote a book about Vietnam like that.
That's true.
No,
it was like these containment zealots like Acheson, and they became rollback zealots and rollback communism wherever you could. And so that's basically NSC 68 in a nutshell, right? Rollback, where you can go after them. And it was a diplomatic decision. It wasn't a military decision. The U.S. national security interests were not threatened in any way by what was happening in Korea. But the U.S. wanted to protect Japan, their prize in the Asia Pacific. And that's why scholars like John Dowling, the famous historian of the occupation, said Japan was basically the super domino of the domino theory. They didn't care about it. They always said, oh, if we don't stop them in Korea, they'll take Southeast Asia, and et cetera, et cetera. But actually, what the U.S. was worried about the whole time was that communists would take Japan. And there was actually a pretty powerful communist movement in Japan after the war. Like, one of the points in the book I'm writing is a lot of people don't know how the first couple of years in Japan of the occupation were actually really, there was a top-down-led democratic revolution. He rewrote Japan's constitution. Women were given the right to vote. Labor unions were allowed to organize, and millions of people joined unions, and workers started taking over factories and stuff like this. And then the U.S. and all these American businessmen that wanted to do business in Japan were like, oh no, Japan's go left. And actually, when John Foster Dulles, he went to South Korea to buoy up, steady the Syngman Rhee after he'd lost his election. And he made that. So every time American presidents go to South Korea, they adopt the same pose as John Foster Dulles, staring resolutely across the border of Korea with his somber. Everybody, Clinton, Bush, they all do the same thing, except the one picture I have of Trump on the DMZ. Now everyone's looking north and he's looking south, glaring at the photographer who's taken the picture. He probably didn't even know what country he was in. But it's this idea. The fact is that Truman, this is famous biography, real establishment historian who wrote the book about him. Jesus, the history is so distorted. And people believe him as, oh, he did the right thing against tremendous odds. He was just a really ill-advised imperial.
Good McCullough.
And who's the guy who's always on CNN? I forget his name. Anyway, I'm getting old. I forget all this stuff, all the details. But yeah, David McCullough, too. And it's bad also, like David Halberstam, who wrote great stuff from Vietnam and probably helped get the U.S. out of Vietnam. If he decided to write a book about Korea, the Korean War, that was just the same shit. Did you not learn anything in Vietnam? He starts the war June 5th, 20th, 1950.
Yeah. What's striking, because I've studied the military in Vietnam, is my first book, and there were only a few people who referenced Vietnam and Korea, and it was military guys. No one in the diplomatic side said that. It was guys in the military who said, hey, look what's happening in Korea. This might not be a good idea. And so they paid attention to what was going on there. And obviously, the forces of rollback and economic interests. Also, didn't Japan use the Korean War as a way to boost its own economy? Wasn't it producing a lot of goods?
Actually, the United States, I mean, when Dulles, this is what's interesting. Dulles goes to Korea June 20th, 1950, something like that. He gives us really vehement speech to the Korean National Assembly. The U.S. will always be with you in your fight against communism, right? And then he has a religious service with like 20,000 North Korean Christians. Then he goes to the border and has that picture of him staring at the North Koreans. Then what does he do? He goes to Japan and he meets with MacArthur and the Secretary of War flew there. I forget Johnson's last name. Yeah. He flew to Tokyo. And so he has to start a war powwow with these guys. And he also meets with all these Japanese businessmen and heads of conglomerates, zaibatsu, that had interests in Korea prior to the war and up to World War II. And it's not quite clear all that they discussed. There's been some documents about that. But clearly, he was there because in 1951, Dulles negotiated the first treaty with Japan, and it was completely unilateral. All the allied countries like Britain and Soviet Union were not included. It was just bilateral, U.S. and Japan. And that gave the U.S. use of its bases for eternity, basically. But like immediately when the war began and when Dulles went there, Japan was in a recession because workers had been taking over factories. Capitalists weren't investing. Like, they didn't know which direction Japan was going to go in. And Truman sent this banker, Joseph Dodge, and he imposed on Japan this, what the IMF would later do in all these third world countries. Cut your government budget, fire public sector workers. And that's what they did, because the public sector workers in Japan were all led by leftist unions and communists. And so they purged all these unions. They purged all communists from all kinds of institutions, universities, and so on. And then they began buying the huge orders for Japanese steel. This is how Nissan was reborn, making Jeeps for the U.S. And Japan's economy it was a miracle for Japan. Suddenly their economy was reborn from the direct result of the U.S. intervention in the Korean War, and they began supplying the U.S. with all its military equipment, lots of its military equipment, not so much the weapons, but what we went into, the steel and piping and all this kind of stuff, and also supplying whatever else was needed, clothing, garments, et cetera. And so Japan's economy shot up, and you can actually go to the State Department official history that's still on the web, says, Korea came along and saved us. And Japan. They admit this openly.
Yeah.
And so that was the first surge. And it's funny when you think about like what's going on with Nippon Steel taking over U.S. Steel and all this stuff. Nippon Steel was reborn during the Korean War with U.S. military procurement orders. And they brought in all these U.S. Steel engineers and people who had been working in U.S. Steel to help them become more productive and all this kind of stuff. So the Japanese economy was jump-started by the war.
And so William Borden, who wrote a book about that a long ago that I think was quite good on that. Was it Borden?
I'm not sure.
Long ago, I read a book which laid that out. That's why I know a bit about it. I think the guy's name was Borden, B-O-R-D-E-N. I'll check. It was really useful.
It's really, and everyone in Japan knows this history, right?
Yeah.
But it's just so unknown here. And very little few people know that's how Japan backed the U.S. during the Korean War. But ironically, what happened was, like in terms of growing up there as a missionary kid, it was like the first missionaries that came and they were helping during the occupation. They were revered by the Japanese because, like, Japanese people after the bombing of Nagasaki, every 600 cities in Japan were wiped off the map, basically, right? Thousands, hundreds of thousands burned to death. So the Japanese people were flat on their backs, and they really were grateful for the American support and not putting them under the heel of another military regime. and they felt liberated in a sense. But when the U.S. started doing this in Korea and doing the same, led by the same people, bombing North Korea, Japanese Christians and the Japanese population really turned against the United States. And they're like, oh, you're a Christian country coming in to tell us how to live? And look what you're doing. What's so special about you? And that created a huge schism. And like I was there in the late 60s, and basically like in Tokyo. I was in Tokyo from 63 to 69, junior high and high school. It's where I graduated from high school, Tokyo. And those are the biggest demonstrations I've ever seen in my life. I'm talking about millions of people on the streets of Tokyo and these left-wing train conductors on the national railways shutting down all the trains. And just Tokyo is the biggest city in the world, right? And they completely shut it down, completely. And it was a huge citizen movement. Like they would block when American sailors on an aircraft carrier would go AWOL and try to get political asylum. Japanese people poured into the streets to support them. And there was a really strong anti-war feeling there. And it's really sad to me to see that under the Liberal Democratic Party, they just went to the U.S. demand that they keep rearming and rearming and rearming. If you remember, during when Biden was having trouble maintaining his candidacy, he was being attacked for being too old or whatever. One of the things that he said to get voters to vote for him was, look, I helped remilitarize Japan. We should all be deeply grateful for that. Yeah. Really did him a lot. But it's just like, that's the mentality. And so much of this history is obscure. And it remains so shameful to me. And like, I was reading this morning about this. I've watched a lot of Korean War movies. You can see them every once in a while. TCM or whatever. And it's just all the white man telling Koreans how to live a better life. And it's such incredible propaganda. It's just unbelievable propaganda that Americans were put through at that
time. I recently rewatched Heartbreak Ridge, which is definitely the propaganda about the sort of white senior Marines who fended off the entire North Korean army their own.
What's interesting is that a lot of these movies at the time were all about Americans fighting in Korea, but they're based in Japan. So all the backstories about the barbarian and the geisha, right? It's all hanging out with geisha and beautiful Japanese woman with all this clingy music playing and Americans tromping around Tokyo. And then their day job is to go bomb Korea and then make his lives. So if anybody was a careful watcher of those movies, they would have seen this war is being fought from Japan. And a lot of Japanese were well aware of that. And they didn't like it. And then it just really blew up during Vietnam. You could literally see planes flying out of the U.S. bases going to Vietnam.
Yeah, I don't know if you have anything. I'm done. I just want to thank you so much. I could talk to you for another 8 hours about this, but... Right. I really appreciate it because it's something we've chatted about this, you and I, for about a month now. And I'm finally glad we finally got to do it. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you back on to take it up to the present.
I would love to talk with you about the 70s and 80s and so, for example.
The 80s are very interesting. And you wait till my book comes out, if it ever comes out. It's like, because I have a lot in there. I was there a lot during the 80s, in South Korea and Japan. And so I reported on the early days of the movement until I was basically kicked out of
South. Also, like to point out, you're a Dylan fanatic like I am. So.
That's the more John Brown, greatest Andy Moore songs ever.
Yeah. Much thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Folks, we've been talking with Tim Sharrock about the anniversary of the Korean War, the 75th anniversary. If you like what you're here, and please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org, hit that support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast.